This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Fort Myers Beach is hosting its second annual sustainable seafood event that this year reels in an aquaculture scientist as its keynote speaker. We'll be talking with her and a Fishtail Marina captain about the event that's dubbed itself a regional seafood experience. But first, we introduced the Critical Thinking Lecture Series on this show a few weeks ago. It's been going on at Florida Southwestern State College all month. And while most of the speakers have focused on modern thought processes in the current fake news era, the closing speaker in the series is focusing on the distant past. Adrian Kerr made his mark as the founder of the nation's largest independent importer of specialty plastics, which explains his spot on the advisory council of the Lutgard College of Business at FGCU. He's also the director of corporate training at FSW. But what some in the business world may not know is that he is also a respected lecturer on ancient civilization and the author of two books on ancient Egypt. Adrian Kerr joins us in the studio today to talk about his upcoming lecture, Critical Thinking in Ancient Egypt. Thanks for joining us, Adrian.
Nice to be with you, Julie.
You can join the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Adrian, with such an extensive business background, how did you first become interested in ancient civilizations?
It started when I was about 14. I used to listen to these rather dull sermons in church on Sundays. And one day my interest was piqued when I heard about Assyrians and Babylonians and Moses and the Exodus and pyramids. And from then it just got more and more interesting. And I just started doing research. And I've really been fascinated by ancient civilizations since then.
And so you kind of focused then on ancient Egypt. What was it about that particular area?
When my family took me to live in India when I was 3 years old, we spent time going through Egypt and also coming back. So I got an exposure to the sands and the pyramids and the Sphinx at a very early age, and I guess it got into my blood.
It kind of stuck with you. And then you started hearing the sermons talking about these places and the history behind it and connecting that history to the images that maybe you had in your mind as a child.
Yeah, what interested me most of all was the how old the civilization was. We think that Greece and Rome are ancient civilizations, but they're relatively modern compared to the Egyptians, which started in the way that we know it around the great cities of the Nile, 4000 BC. Which is way before any other civilization got started. And it was the earliness of the civilization which still attracts me, and that they developed a lot of concepts, ideas, writing, trade, and building well before the Greeks and the Romans.
Yet me remained mysterious for quite a bit longer.
Indeed. The problem with Egyptians was they left us no written, easy-to-read records. Everything we know about ancient Egypt, and I mean it's pretty much everything, apart from the occasional papyruses on medical or astronomy subjects, everything is written on the temple walls and palace walls. So we had to understand hieroglyphics before we could understand the history. So any book written before 1900 is very sketchy in its accuracy. And once the hieroglyphics are translated in the mid-19th century, suddenly we had the whole of the history and the reigns of the kings and the events that took place in front of us.
It helped the critical thinking of the scholars at that time, for sure. So what do you think that modern critical thinkers can learn from the way that knowledge was approached in ancient Egypt?
The first book I wrote, called Ancient Egypt and Us, really identified that particular issue, and that many people think that the issues that we have to combat today are new and difficult to grapple with. But in fact, if you take most of the current issues throughout the world, we can trace back early examples to 2,500 BC. So for 4,500 years, we've been struggling with the concepts that we have today pretty much. And if we draw parallels between ancient history and modern times, we can learn a lot.
Well, there's the ego of the human condition where we think we're the first to ever experience anything.
Yeah.
But can you give me an example of something that maybe we're going through now that might have a parallel from back then?
Well, if you go to the United Nations building in New York, when it was built in the 60s, the Turkish government gave a copy of the very first peace treaty ever identified in the ancient world, which is about 1500 BC. And so back in 1500 BC, the Egyptians and the Hittites agreed not to fight each other. They buried the hatchet and they put together what is today a recognized peace treaty, which we follow in the United Nations. So that was 3,500 years ago. So the concept of peace versus war isn't new.
Yeah, it's just it. When we think about critical thinking today, we think about verifying information that we've been handed or oftentimes passively fed through social media or TV, maybe fact-checking things, learning the source of the information and whatever biases it may have. What kind of critical thinking are you referring to in your lecture?
It's a very good point you raise, because if you have 4,000 years of history and there's only one source, which is the ancient Egyptian text, you're in that gray area of relying on one source for all information. Where Egyptian history really comes alive is when the other civilizations in the Middle East, so we have the Hittites, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, Palestine and Israel, all of those civilizations, as they grew up, began to develop writing techniques. And so from around about 1500 BC onwards, we don't have to rely entirely on the Egyptian story for accuracy. We can now cross-check it. And from the biblical Old Testament records, we now know that anything from 1000 BC onwards can be checked back to other civilizations who are at war with them or trading with them or intermarried. And so the accuracy and the detail of ancient Egypt is much clearer from 1000 BC onwards.
So before 1500 BC, we were seeing the perfect lighting and all the filters on the selfie for Egypt. But after that, we were starting to see the different angles and other people's perceptions of what Egypt was like.
Correct. And Egypt really had its the area to itself for the best part of 1,000 years, from the period of the pre-pyramid building, 2500 BC, to around about 2000 BC. It was surrounded by desert or the Mediterranean on the north side, and it kept itself to itself. There was no other civilization which challenged it, and they had all the gold in the world at that time, so life was good. It's only when the other civilizations grew up and brought in new technology. And there's a hark back to the point you made. What can we learn? If you look inwards too long, you find that your neighbors have developed new technology. In this case, the new technology was chariots, which the Egyptians didn't have, and the curved bow, which was much more powerful. And they lost the northern part of their kingdom to these Asiatics, as they called them, from Palestine. And it really shook them up. And from then onwards, Egypt was no longer all powerful. It had to see itself in the international environment.
What kind of things changed as far as modern perception of Egypt once when you're looking at Egypt through that lens and you're looking at through the Egypt-only lens, Egypt-centric, I guess we can call that. And then how did understanding of Egypt change when looking at it from a different perspective? How did other cultures rising up around Egypt see it?
Egypt was the most powerful country in the Middle East for 2,000 years. And of course, if you read the Egyptian narrative, of course, they always win battles. Their kings are supreme. They love their people. The people are well fed. The Nile flows every year and so on. It's only when you read between the lines and you get a second opinion where maybe the Egyptians, it wasn't all sweetness and light. And of course, the Egyptian history is split into three parts, the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, and the New Kingdom. And there are periods of hundreds of years when the economy and the central rule of Egypt collapsed between those three kingdoms. And so clearly ecological factors came into effect. The Old Kingdom, which built the pyramids, crashed because of ecological disaster in the Middle East and then rebuilt and so on. So there's three different parts of Egyptian history.
I think it's interesting to see that they even back then, were putting a spin on things to make it look all shiny and great.
But then occasionally there's a spotlight appears on a papyrus which tells you a different story. For instance, we have a papyrus in the British Museum which tells you about the harem conspiracy to kill the king and the court case that went on to investigate whether the perpetrators were in fact guilty or not. And it's written out in a day-by-day narrative. So here's a case of them showing their dirty linen in public. And this would not have been known to the majority of the people of Egypt, of course, but they actually recorded that case against the conspirators and what happened to them, the punishment they got. And it's recorded on a papyrus, which we can read today, and that's dated about 1600 BC.
What punishment did they get?
Well, it's rather scary, but if you remember that mummification was a way to preserve the body so that your spirit and soul, the ba and the ka, could carry on in the afterlife forever. So you had to keep the body together. That's why mummification became essential. And you had to take out all the bits in the body that could rot and then put in salt to preserve the body for eternity and then bury it safely in a tomb so that nothing could happen to it. And then your spirit each day could go into the afterlife and return to the body thereafter. So the trick was, if you had a criminal, in this case it was the second wife of the king who conspired to put her son on the throne, then she, because she was a queen, she was allowed to commit suicide, but the other members of the conspiratory were either skinned alive, put on stakes, or cut into pieces, or burnt, or all of those, because that way the body doesn't stay intact and their soul can't go to the afterlife.
Oh, that's quite the punishment. I mean, brutal, yes. But also, even all the way into the afterlife, they're punished just forever. So ancient Egyptians are thought to be the most literary of ancient peoples, and they wrote quite a lot. And when they did, they used hieroglyphs as their writing system, but the symbols in it are allegorical, meaning that they relate to, oftentimes, nouns directly. Does that leave things more open for interpretation?
Yeah, hieroglyphics is exceptionally difficult to read because, as you mentioned, they can mean a letter or they can mean a noun or even a nuance. And so you really – people who can read hieroglyphics, it's very challenging to get the right translation. The Egyptians themselves started off their writing process was not for great proclamations from kings or the announcement of holidays or taxation or great victories in war. The first writing in the world came from Egypt and possibly also the area of Iraq today. It's a close-run thing as who was the first developer. But both civilizations created writing, and the purpose of writing was for trade. It was to label goods, saying, Julie, I bought your donkey, or I'm going to sell you this wine, or this in my warehouse belongs to me. So the very first writing on the planet was to do with ownership of assets.
And commerce, right?
Commerce.
And making sure that you're getting what you paid for and having a receipt.
Correct.
Like I got a bad donkey.
That's exactly right. And they were written on ivory labels about 2 inches by 2 inches and had your name, and it identified that possession as being yours.
Hmm. I wonder what that tells us about they found that there was a need to develop language for that purpose.
Correct.
But not for other purposes.
It then developed into a more sophisticated communication system. But remember, less than 1% of the population of ancient Egypt could read or write. So the people who wrote things down were scribes, intellectuals, and people of substance. They owned things and they wanted to have it recorded as such.
Well, controlling literacy has always been a power play for centuries ever since then. But I think it's interesting, though, that the first thing that they felt such a compelling need to develop a written language was for commerce. Yeah. So I guess we're not the only capitalists in the world. So leaving it open for interpretation like that, when these hieroglyphs can have different meanings and innuendos, did that make it difficult for people to fact check things?
Yes. We talked about it a little bit earlier. We have to rely entirely on the context, and we have to guess a lot of stuff to do with hieroglyphics. But as times went on from the middle of the 19th century onwards, we got a pretty good handle on the extensiveness and application of hieroglyphics. And it's now from 1900 onwards, the books of ancient Egypt pretty much have got it right.
So ancient Egyptians are best known for their great pyramids, the Sphinx. How much thought would have to go into building these structures without modern technology?
This is a question I'm asked a lot, and that many people consider alternatives. New Age people say it would be space men who've come to help the Egyptians build the pyramids. There was an interesting experiment done about 15 years ago, and they actually started to cut blocks and assemble a new pyramid in the old style, which is using old tools, using copper chisels.
They tried to recreate the actual construction.
The building of a pyramid. And it's only then that people began to accept that with a lot of people, like 10 or 20,000 people working for 10 or 15 years, moving blocks from the quarry up to the place of the pyramid, and then skilled artisans would place those blocks. And they actually calculated that a group of 8 Egyptians could move a block from the quarry up a ramp, put it at the base of the pyramid, and then the artisans, the stonemasons, would trim it and put it into the pyramid, and a new block, which is about 3 foot by 3 foot by 3 foot cube, could be placed in the pyramid every 2 minutes. So that way, over a number of years, you build up this pyramid to which it is today, which is 455 feet high, and 2 million pieces all work together using old technology.
Was there any point in your study of Egypt that you believed the spaceman theory?
Only my daughter, who keeps sending me Facebook and messages saying, here's a picture I took of a spaceship over the pyramid, so you're wrong, Dad.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, though, that we felt – in this day and age, that we needed to fact check the fact that the pyramids were built by people.
Yes. There are still lots of books written from people who don't accept the classical theory. And even more, they believe that the Egyptians who built the pyramids weren't building them at 2,500 BC. They were built 14,000 years BC. And the Sphinx, some people have actually wrongly dated the Sphinx to between 10 and 14,000 years, which, if that was true, means that there was a civilization of the sophistication of the Egyptians 10,000 years before the Egyptians. Now, that just throws all the cards in the air. I mean, that changes history. They made mistakes. And as time's gone on, of course, you need 100 brilliant minds to disprove one fool. And the people who've come up with these theories over the years have the evidence has been shown to be inaccurate. But of course, it's the sensation of publishing, if Sphinx is 14,000 years old and 10,000 years before the pyramids, who built it, captures the headlines. 3 years later, when that work has been evaluated by experts and proven to be wrong, nobody reads that article.
Nobody reads that article, and they still remember that one headline.
Correct.
But let's go back to the headline that I'm going to extrapolate from this, which is, you need 1,000 brilliant minds to disprove one fool. I would like to have a bumper sticker made that says that. Is it 1,000 or 100,000 brilliant minds to disprove one fool?
Your choice.
It was great. That is just the quote of the day. Yeah. We are talking about critical thinking in ancient Egypt. You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So, Adrian, the ancient Egyptians were famously polytheistic, with a system of gods and demigods complex enough to rival ancient Greece and Rome. But those civilizations are often the ones that are credited with giving history its great thinkers and groundbreaking philosophical advances. Why is it that Egypt isn't known for the same?
The reason for me writing my books in ancient Egypt was try to correct that belief, and that most of us grew up following a classical education. I don't think there are many people study Latin and Greek as they used to do 30, 40, 50 years ago. But a lot of our modern education system was based on the respect and the love of classical education. And we gave a lot of credit to the Greeks for discovering and identifying and writing about new things. Romans followed on from that. So we tend to look at the Greeks and Romans as being making breakthroughs in technology and astronomy and medicine and democracy. And indeed, they deserve credit for some of those things. But if you look in detail, let's take Pythagoras' theorem. Now, everybody remembers in high school the right angle triangle, 3-4-5 triangle, and it's given the name to this day as the Pythagoras, the Greek mathematician's triangle that he discovered. I could show you a papyrus in the Louvre, which was dated to 1600 BC, 1,000 years before the Greeks ever got to Egypt, where the Pythagoras triangle was outlined, and you had a question, a high school test, a mathematical test, is calculate the area of this Pythagoras triangle. So Pythagoras, when he went to Egypt and he was amazed at pyramids and structures, realized they had to calculate the volumes. You can't just sit down one day and build a 450-foot high pyramid. You have to plan it. How much stone are we going to have? Where's the stone coming from? How many blocks? Who's going to cut the blocks? That requires mathematics. So they had to have a very sophisticated way to know the resources they needed to build not only pyramids but temples and tombs. Naturally, they needed math. And all the math that you can think of in the Greek terms as being revolutionary were copies of the Egyptian work that predates them by 1,000 years. So the Egyptians have had a bad rap in that because we're dominated in our thinking by how great the Greeks were and the Romans were, we tend to forget that a lot of their thinking, particularly in astronomy and mathematics, medicine, for instance, I can show you the Ebers Papyrus in the British Museum, which probably is 2000 BC. The copy is 1400 BC. And it shows you what to do when somebody comes into an emergency room. And we think the triage is a modern concept. Triage was developed by the Egyptians 2000 BC. So are they breathing? Are they bleeding? Is there any pain, any broken limbs? That was laid out in this papyrus. How do you treat cancer? How do you treat childbirth pains? How do you treat headache? And what do you use for headache pills versus, say, a cancer pain? And they identify all this, and there are hundreds of different types of drugs. Their drug of choice was willow bark, because willow bark contains the active ingredient of aspirin. So aspirin was alive and well 3000 BC.
Wow. So Cleopatra had a headache and had to have an aspirin.
Correct. That's right.
She could ask for a pyrin tablet from Birdcage. It's just really mind-blowing, though, when you think about it, that they already were doing all of this, but we just didn't seem to know. And you said that they cracked the hieroglyphics code and started to understand what the Egyptians knew. At what point did we figure that out?
The first true book of ancient Egypt was James Henry Breasted, University of Chicago, around about 1900. And he decided to go on a world tour looking at all of the inscriptions on temples, tombs, pyramids throughout the world, and in Egypt, of course, and then go to the museums and copy all of those and translate them himself. And then he had the knowledge to put together the history of ancient Egypt. So from 1900 onwards, we became much more aware of what the Egyptians had done. And, of course, tomb robbers from the 17th century had been bringing stuff to Europe from an out-of-context, papyruses, headstones and such. And so a lot of Egyptian material was beginning to emerge in the middle 19th century, and that set fire to the love of ancient Egypt. And that's when we have tourists start, and boat trips to Egypt come at Christmas time, the weather's perfect. And so Egyptomania started around about, in big time, about in the middle of the 19th century, when hieroglyphics were being translated, and it just grew and grew and grew since then.
So by the time we figured out what Egypt knew, which we didn't even know what they knew, but that was about the time that we figured out what they knew. But at that point, we have already been entrenched for hundreds of years in the Greeks and the Romans, and they discovered this, and they figured this out. And look at – so right. I guess Egypt ended up being late to the party, even though they were the first ones to figure it out.
Indeed. And let's take a simple example. People still say, oh, yes, the sailors who traveled with Columbus to discover the New World were frightened if they went too far away from land, they'd fall over the edge of the land because it was flat. No educated person from the Egyptians onwards thought the planet was flat. The Egyptians proved 2000 BC that the Earth was a sphere, and they actually calculated the circumference of the sphere to within 15% of its true circumference, 2000 BC.
They were pretty good at the math.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I can come up with that. I'm pretty sure I couldn't. So we're approaching Halloween. It's the season of mummies. And we mentioned earlier a little bit about the religious meaning and the necessity for mummification. But what kind of science had to happen in order to figure that out?
Do you remember the driving force for mummification was preserving the body intact exactly so that it could go to the afterlife and enjoy the life there forever? So the first mummification was accidental. You take great-great-granddad and he had died. You take him out to the desert because you don't want to bury him in agricultural land. That's a waste of good land. And you bury him in the sand and you cover him up and you leave him. And then you go and bury somebody else and you find 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years later, the person that you put in the dry sand is still there. It's the dry sand and the lack of water meant that his body is preserved. That's natural mummification. And we saw that in the border between Austria and Italy. Uzi was found the same time about 3,000 years ago, 3,000 BC, and he was crossing over the Alps and he was attacked and he died and the ice covered him and he was preserved in a frozen concept. So there's two examples of desiccation through natural effects and freezing, keeping the bodies intact. Then people said, well, maybe we can actually bury our old in tombs and keep them intact as well. But of course, then you disturb the fact it's no longer dry, water can get in, animals can attack, so they buried them down in the ground and they had to preserve them in some way. So initially, they desiccated them by putting salt on the skin and then taking out the squidgy bits in your body that aren't needed, put them in canopic jars so they can stay with you near your body but not in your body, and that way the body's preserved. Later, they started using special oils to preserve the body even better in Roman times, and then finally, the Greeks and the Romans started painting the face of the individual on the outside of the casket. The reason being that when your spirit flies out of your body every night to go into the afterlife, he has to come back and find you again the next morning. And having a face on the coffin of, oh, yeah, that's my body, is handy.
Tough going into the wrong one, yeah. Whoops. So but it's funny because we have that level of knowledge and that level of scientific certainty about what happens after someone dies. But then you go into the Middle Ages, for example, and people seem to have forgotten everything that happens with the decomposition of a body, and they started crediting people that get bloated with coming back as vampires. So it's just the seesaw of human knowledge and how they know, and then they just kind of come up with explanations that, like, aliens building the pyramids.
It's an interesting point you raise, because the first use of mummies in Europe was for medicine. So they would dig up mummies in ancient Egypt, and they'd ship them in dozens and dozens on ships to Europe. And then the mummies would be ground up in a pestle and mortar into a powder and sit in an apothecary shop. And so if you had an indigestion, you had a period pain, you had a headache, you would go to the equivalent of CVS and Walgreens and you say, "What have you got for me today, pharmacist?" And they would say, "Well, here's a really powerful thing. It's mumia." And you would have this ground-up mummy, and you'd take it with water or alcohol, and that would make you feel better. So imagine taking an old body that had been ground up 4,000 years ago as a medicine. That shows you how the medieval people treated medicine compared to the Egyptians, which knew better.
Yeah, the Dark Ages for sure. Right. Speaking of mummies, the Mummy movie franchise has recently risen from the dead. And as a scholar, I'm sure it sounds silly for me to ask, but I promise you that I have asked paleontologists about Jurassic Park. How historically accurate are these movies?
It varies. It's very patchy. I mean, Hollywood makes a number of errors knowingly in showing these types of movies. First of all, they've got to make it glamorous and they've got to make it big scene. So, for instance, if you think of a typical mummy or Egyptian movie, when they find the treasure in the tomb has to be big enough for the whole film crew and the set in Hollywood. And so you have tombs which are 30, 40 feet high and a couple hundred feet long, with scarab beetles coming around and mummies coming alive and chasing Harrison Ford and all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. If you go to a tomb in the Valley of the Kings, you have to bend over and get into the doorway, and then you walk into a very narrow passage which is no more than 6 foot high. The biggest, the width would be 4 foot. You go into the area where the sarcophagus is sitting, and the maximum height is about 8 or 10 feet, and no bigger than the studio, which is 12 foot, say, square. So if you think about building a tomb underground with a massive rocks above you, they didn't have the technology to have reinforced structures, and so they had to live with the materials they had, which was granite or limestone or the bedrock itself. And if you made the room too big, the roof fell in. So that's the biggest discrepancy that Hollywood has, in that nearly always they'll show, and somewhere during the movie, the treasure room, and it's huge. Maybe even a river flowing through it.
Yeah, I believe that it's probably not super realistic, but I think that going into one of those, there would be some claustrophobia for some people.
Well, if you're brave enough, first of all, to get into the Great Pyramid, there's only 150 tickets sold because our moisture is condensing and damaging the stone.
Breathing, yeah.
Breathing. So you're climbing up through 450 feet of stone to get to where the sarcophagus is. And the passageway is, in this case, the passageway is about 5'2". So you're doubled over, and the width of the passageway is about 3 to 4 feet. And many people get claustrophobia, and they have to be taken out. And, of course, the Egyptians play a marvelous trick in that this is all dark, and you're climbing up and up and up into this massive 2 million tons of stone, and then lights go out. You should hear the screams. And because
they do that on purpose?
I've never proven that, but it happens nearly every time I go into the Great Pyramid.
Do you remember the first time you went in?
I do. Yes.
What did it feel like? I mean, you had studied it by then since you started at 14, I imagine.
I knew where I was going, first of all. So the entrance, the modern entrance, is not the original entrance. It was cut into the pyramid in tomb robber days in the Middle Ages. So you go through a convoluted series of passages which are fairly modern, and then you start climbing up. And it was never intended for tourists. It was intended for use once, to put the body of the king in and then close it off. But it's amazing when you go inside, because despite the fact it's only going to be used once in and out, the walls are perfectly smooth and the highest quality stonemason work. And you can hardly see the joins between the blocks of stones. It's incredible how much respect they had for the dead, that they would put so much work into something that's never going to be seen.
I think it's so interesting. I'm pretty sure I couldn't. Does that lead people to believe maybe that Egyptians were shorter than they really were?
Egyptians were shorter than we're used to today. But more importantly, the typical age that you could hope to reach in ancient Egypt was under 30. So if you got to 30, you were old. If you were 40, you were very old. If you got to 60, you were a freak, because they had bad nutrition. There was warfare. There was pestilence. There were accidents. There was not very good medical coverage, no ER rooms as such, and so on. So if you broke a leg, there's a very good chance you'd die from it. So to reach 30 in ancient Egypt, you're really doing well.
Wow. So this is going to be a great speech. You're going to be speaking on the Tuesday, the 24th?
Yes.
And that's 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes.
Correct. So anyone can go, I guess. I guess they have to sign up ahead of time. I'm sure it's going to be crowded.
It's open to the public, and you don't have to sign up in advance.
All right. Well, thank you for coming and talking with us. It's been really fun. I've been looking forward to talking with you all week, so I'm glad that you're here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Julie.
Coming up, a sustainable seafood event has lured a renowned marine researcher to Fort Myers Beach to talk about the projects that she's spearheading at Moat Marine Research Laboratory. We'll talk with Dr. Kevin Main and a local charter fishing boat captain about the event that's calling itself a regional seafood experience. We'll be right back.